The Erie Canal was the first major waterway built in the United States. Opened in 1825, it crossed the state of New York from Buffalo near Niagara Falls in the west to Albany on the Hudson River in the east.
About half an hour's drive east of Rochester lies the small town of Port Gibson. Located on the canal, it was once the main shipping point for the area. It was also the home of an active Methodist layman, Hiram Edson, who in 1843 accepted the message of the soon coming of Christ taught by William Miller and his associates.
With tens of thousands of others across the United States, the Millerites of Port Gibson waited with earnest expectation for October 22, 1844. For on this day they expected the Lord to come as the fulfillment of the 2,300-day prophecy of Daniel 8:14. But as the clear morning light of the following day shone upon the canal waters, these same believers were overcome with disappointment and despair. Just how they came to see beyond their own misunderstanding to the clear light of God's leading in three distinct ways is the substance of our story. There were many Adventist believers who gathered at Hiram Edson's farm on October 22, 1844. Researchers established that this was his house, though rooms have been added on both sides since the time Edson lived here. On that cool October morning, the disappointment of Edson and his friends became all too real.
That slips off the tongue mighty easily, young fella.
I beg your pardon, sir?
I don't think you have any idea how devastated we were.
What do you mean?
I'm telling you, we experienced the worst kind of doubt. Some of us with more bitterness than others. We wondered if the prophecies of Daniel were wrong. We wondered if maybe the Bible was a fairy tale. And some of us even wondered if there was still a God in heaven. We went to my barn back there and we prayed. And after re-examining our faith, we decided that there had to be an answer to our dilemma.
And what was that?
Well, after we'd eaten breakfast, I suggested to young Owen Crozier that we visit some of our neighbors in the area here and see if we could encourage them a bit. I'm not sure if it was because of our fear of our mocking neighbors, but anyway, we headed out across my cornfield. All that corn. We'd been so sure of Christ's second coming that I'd left a whole crop standing in the field. Have an ear of New York's finest.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You know, as we walked along that morning, and I reviewed in my mind the events of the previous 24 hours, suddenly I stopped and looked up into heaven, and it seemed as if the heavens opened, and across my mind flashed the arrangement of the sanctuary. You know, we Millerites had been preaching the text, until 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. And we thought that that sanctuary was this earth. Well, later we realized that the Bible teaches that there's a sanctuary in heaven too. And Christ had moved, like the high priest in the Day of Atonement, from the holy place to the most holy place on October 22, 1844. Our Lord had a work to perform in heaven before returning to this earth. That's where Brother Miller had made his mistake. The Lord was good. He had heard our morning prayer. Well, so long, young fella.
So long. In the following months, Hiram Edson and his associates continued to study the subject of the sanctuary and its cleansing. As they thought of their own experience, they marveled at the similarities between their own disappointment and that of the disciples at the time of Jesus' crucifixion.
Eventually, Edson persuaded his friend Crozier to publish their findings in an extra edition of the Millerite journal, The Day Star, February 7, 1846.
But meanwhile, a second significant development was taking place here in Washington, New Hampshire. 2 years earlier, in 1844, a Seventh-day Baptist lady had shared with a group of Millerite believers here her conviction that the seventh day of the week should be observed as the Sabbath.
The Christian observance of the seventh-day Sabbath has persisted throughout the Christian era. At times it has been driven underground, but it has always reappeared to urge its message upon the world. From the days of the apostles down to the 5th century, it continued in various parts of the Roman Empire. However, as the Christian church slipped further and further into apostasy and adopted the idolatrous rites and practices of sun worship, the seventh-day Sabbath was soon discredited, its observance suppressed, and in its place, Sunday was exalted as the day of worship. During the Reformation of the 16th century, Luther took his stand on the Bible as the supreme authority for the Christian. To Charles V, he declared,
"I do not accept the authority of popes and councils, for they have contradicted each other. My conscience is captive to the word of God."
This appeal to the Bible and the Bible only was the very foundation of the Reformation. As the Reformation continued, dialogue soon arose within the church over the question of Sunday and the Sabbath. The Sabbath keepers asserted that there was no Bible support for the observance of Sunday. As a result, the observance of the seventh-day Sabbath spread throughout Europe, including England. There, agitation over the Sabbath became the center of controversy among the Puritans throughout the 17th century. Influential people were involved. Among the many who advocated the observance of the seventh day was a London barrister and a Commonwealth Speaker of the House of Commons. By the mid-1660s, there were many congregations in England keeping the seventh day. A member of one of them was Dr. Peter Chamberlain, physician to three Stuart kings, James I, Charles I, and Charles II of England. A contemporary of John Bunyan, Chamberlain was a keen Bible student.
On his tombstone in the churchyard at Woodham Mortimer, these words have been written: "As for his religion, he was a Christian, keeping the commandments of God and faith of Jesus, being baptized about the year 1648, and keeping the seventh day for the Sabbath above 32 years.
Chamberlain was a member of the Seventh-day Baptist Church, a small group that had separated from the Baptist Church in the early 1600s because of their convictions concerning the Sabbath. In 1664, Stephen Mumford, a Seventh-day Baptist from England, emigrated to the New World. In 1671, he organized the first Seventh-day Baptist church in America at Newport, Rhode Island. During the next 170 years, their influence spread throughout America until in 1843, Seventh-day Baptists numbered about 5,500. In that year, their general conference voted on a most significant resolution:
"That the first day of November next be observed by our churches as a day of fasting and prayer, that Almighty God will arise and plead for his holy Sabbath."
Little did they anticipate the manner or the magnitude of the answer to their prayer. Within months of their day of prayer, a Seventh-day Baptist widow, Mrs. Rachel Oakes, decided to move to the little village of Washington, New Hampshire. Her 18-year-old daughter, Delight, had accepted a position there as a schoolteacher. Driving into Washington today, the marker on the roadside states that this is the birthplace of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. What happened here to attract such a title? This sturdy wooden church is today located far from the town centre, but once it was set in the middle of a thriving farm community. In 1844, Frederick Wheeler was the Methodist circuit riding pastor of this church. 2 years earlier, after reading William Miller's books, Wheeler began to teach the soon coming of Jesus. The majority of his congregation here also adopted Miller's teachings. One Sunday morning, Wheeler was at this desk in the Washington, New Hampshire church, conducting the communion service. During the sermon, he encouraged the people to be faithful in keeping all 10 of God's commandments. Mrs. Oakes, the Seventh-day Baptist, who was attending here for fellowship, could hardly contain herself. When the pastor visited her soon after, she seized her opportunity.
I'm glad to see you.
Good to see you.
I've been looking forward to this. I want to talk to you about something important.
What is the subject today?
Come in.
Thank you, Mrs. Oakes. It's a lovely fire.
In Sunday service, Reverend Wheeler, you said that everyone who confesses Christ should obey all God's commandments.
I am strongly of that opinion, sister.
Well, I'll be making it clear. I came near standing up right then and there and saying something.
I sensed as such. What did you want to say?
I wanted to tell you that you had best put that cloth back on the communion table until you begin to keep all God's commandments yourself, including the fourth.
And so Frederick Wheeler was introduced to the Sabbath truth. Soon after, he kept his first Sabbath, preached a sermon on it, and thus became the first Sabbath-keeping Adventist minister. Not long after the great disappointment, William Farnsworth, then in his late 30s, stood up in the Farnsworth family pew during the service and declared his intention to keep the Sabbath also.
He was soon followed by his younger brother Cyrus, who was in his early 20s, his own wife and father and others. Forced to withdraw from fellowship, these first Sabbath keepers met in the large Farnsworth home not far away. It was not until some years later that they acquired eventual ownership of this church. Adjacent to the church is the graveyard where many of these early Seventh-day Sabbath keepers lie buried. This marker reveals that Cyrus Farnsworth later married Rachel Delight Oakes, the schoolteacher and daughter of Mrs. Rachel Oakes. A short time after Wheeler commenced to keep the Sabbath, a second Millerite minister, Thomas Preble, joined him.
Preble was a free will Baptist who had travelled with William Miller and proclaimed the soon coming of Jesus. He became the first Sabbath-keeping Adventist to advocate the seventh-day Sabbath in printed form in an article he published in February 1845.
Among the many who read his article which was later printed as a tract, was Joseph Bates, a retired sea captain. He was impressed with its truth. Some years before, Bates had accepted the teachings of William Miller. He held key positions in the Millerite movement and managed to weather the storm of the disappointment of 1844 without losing his faith. Hearing of the company of Sabbath keepers in Washington, he journeyed there, but on the way met with Frederick Wheeler on his Hillsboro farm.
The Sabbath, just having difficulty.
They studied the Bible together throughout the night.
What I do study, I feel confident, is...
Next morning, they both went to Washington to Cyrus Farnsworth's home.
What do you think about it?
Here at the Farnsworth home in 1845, after further study with Wheeler and Farnsworth, Bates made his decision about the Sabbath. Returning home, Bates was crossing the bridge between Fairhaven and New Bedford, Massachusetts. Only the approaches to the bridge remain today. On the bridge, Bates met an old friend, James Madison Munro Hall, who asked him a question. What's the news, Captain Bates?
The news is that the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord our God.
And Bates devoted the remainder of his life to proclaiming that news. In August of 1846, Bates published his own tract, The Seventh Day Sabbath, A Perpetual Sign. Its contents pointed to a spiritual heritage received not only from the Seventh-day Baptists, but also from the English Puritans and others before them. It contained as well an important new idea that heralded the prophetic significance of the developing Seventh-day Adventist Church. After Bates had begun to keep the Sabbath, he noticed something that the Millerites had overlooked. They had seen their movement as the fulfillment of the first and second angels' messages of Revelation 14, which were to be proclaimed prior to the second coming of Jesus. But there was also a third angel's message. Bates noted that Revelation 14 and verse 12 describes the people who are preaching these messages as those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. This confirmed in his mind the importance of keeping the commandments. It seemed to him that the time had come for a people who had proclaimed the first and second angels' messages to recognize the third message and to keep the commandments of God and the Sabbath, the fourth command enjoined. Earlier in 1846, Bates received a copy of the Daystar Extra, which explained Hiram Edson's insights into the heavenly sanctuary and Christ's ministry in the most holy place. He began to correspond with Edson and accepted his invitation to a conference to be held in Port Gibson later that year. There, Edson shared his insights into the sanctuary, but Bates too had something to share. As Bates outlined his reasons for keeping the seventh-day Sabbath, Edson jumped to his feet and declared, "That is light and truth. The seventh day is the Sabbath, and I am with you to keep it." And keep it he did till the day of his death. But in his conversation with the Port Gibson leaders, Bates also began to see a connection between the Sabbath and Christ's ministry in the most holy place of the heavenly sanctuary. Jesus was at the center of both teachings. In one, he was the all-sufficient sacrifice as God's Lamb, as well as High Priest, ministering the blood and cleansing the sanctuary. In the other, he was the creator of the world and giver of true rest. The 1846 conference was the first public expression of such a connection. At this conference, Bates listened with great interest to Edson's ideas about the heavenly sanctuary. He knew that the Bible taught that the Ark of the Covenant was located in the sanctuary's second apartment, and that inside the Ark were the Ten Commandments. With great interest, therefore, he read Revelation 11:18, which speaks of the final days of Earth's history, when the nations would be angry and the time had come for the world's last judgment. But then in the next verse he read that at the same time the temple of God, or the heavenly sanctuary, was to be opened, and there was seen in his temple the Ark of his Testament. Bates reasoned that if Jesus' ministry in the most holy place was now the focus of attention, then the Ark, its law, and the seventh-day Sabbath that law commanded also assumed new importance. The fulfillment of the 2,300-year prophecy in 1844 had therefore drawn attention to the heavenly sanctuary in a way never seen before. As a result, two special emphases concerning Jesus emerged. First, he was now engaged in his final work as our high priest in the most holy ministry of that sanctuary. Second, he was Lord of the Sabbath day and had both commanded the seventh day to be kept holy and observed it himself as our divine example. But there was to be a third distinguishing sign associated with God's great final proclamation of the gospel. It too was to come from Jesus, for in Revelation 12:17 it is identified as the testimony of Jesus. Just what does this mean? In Revelation 12, John describes the woman clothed with the sun representing the church. He sees her waiting for the birth of Jesus, then persecuted and led away into the wilderness, where God protects her for a period of 1,260 years. Verse 17 then says, "The dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus." A comparison between Revelation 19:10 and 22:8 reveals that the testimony of Jesus, declared to be the spirit of prophecy, operates through the prophets, those individuals he has chosen to speak his testimony to his people. The Old Testament prophet Joel records, "And afterward, I will pour out my spirit on all people. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your old men will dream dreams. Your young men will see visions. Even on my servants, both men and women, I will pour out my spirit in those days." The context of these verses points to their ultimate fulfillment in the days before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. The 19th century revealed several impressive fulfillments of this prediction. In the late 1830s, a young American black who was converted at the age of 17 moved here to Boston, Massachusetts, to prepare for the gospel ministry. His name was William Foy. During 1842, Foy received two impressive visions. He later published a description in a pamphlet entitled "The Christian Experience of William E. Foy," together with the two visions he received in the months of January and February, 1842. On Tuesday evening, January 18, 1842, 23-year-old Foy was meeting with a group of Christians for prayer and Bible study here in Beacon Hill, Boston. During the meeting, he experienced the first of four visions. It lasted for 2.5 hours.
during which a Dr. Cummings examined him and could find, and I quote, no appearance of life except around the heart.
Dear brother,
in his vision,
sisters,
Foy witnessed the rewards given to the righteous at the second coming and was shown the matchless beauty of heaven. He was hesitant to share his visions, for he knew the prejudice against blacks. But less than 3 weeks later, he was given another vision while meeting in a crowded church. This vision, lasting 12 and a half hours, revealed the scenes of the Great Judgment Day.
It is with deep regret that I must now pass judgment upon your life. As a child, you were fortunate to have the benefit of God-fearing and loving parents.
As the scenes passed before him, he saw that neither profession, politics, nor status can save, only a relationship with Christ. In fact, if notice had been taken of his vision concerning the pre-Advent judgment, perhaps the great disappointment 2 years later may have been softened, if not avoided altogether. Foy was told to relate to others what he had seen, and during the months that followed, he preached extensively, creating a sensation wherever he went. Vast crowds heard him tell of what he had seen of the heavenly world and the need to prepare for it. It appears that two more visions were given to him, including one revealing three steps to the heavenly city, which he did not understand.
For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And there shall be famines, pestilences.
No more visions were given to William Foy after the disappointment. However, he maintained his hope in the second coming of Christ. He continued as an esteemed and beloved preacher in small rural communities, finally settling in East Sullivan, Maine.
And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached unto all the world for a witness unto all nations.
There he died in November 1893. And was buried here in the Birch Tree Cemetery. Shortly before the great disappointment, God placed the prophetic gift on another, Hazen Foss, who lived in Poland, Maine. He was 25 years old, well-educated, a good speaker, and a believer in the soon coming of Jesus. In his first vision, he was shown the journey of the Advent people to the city of God. It corroborated with Foy's visions and included a view of three steps by which God's people approach the holy city. After the disappointment, he was told to relate what he had seen. Fearing opposition, Foss refused.
In a second vision, he was again urged to share what he had seen, but still he refused. A third vision followed, in which he was told that he was released and that the burden would be laid upon one of the weakest of the weak, who would do the Lord's bidding.
A few weeks later, Foss stood outside the door of a little chapel, listening to a miraculous story. He was urged to come into the meeting, but he refused.
The manna, almonds, figs, pomegranates, and grapes, and the other fruit. I asked Jesus to let me eat of them. He said, not now. Those that eat of this fruit return to earth no more. You must go back and relate to others what I have revealed to you. Then an angel bore me gently down.
What he heard was an account of a vision almost identical to the one given him.
Who was it that Foss saw that night?
Her name was Ellen Harmon, a 17-year-old girl so ravaged by tuberculosis it threatened to take her life. She could barely speak in a whisper and was often wakened from sleep by coughing and bleeding in her lungs.
Yet God took this weakest of the weak and called her to give the testimony of Jesus to his people. Empowered by God's Spirit, she was to bear that testimony for the next 70 years. The explanation of the sanctuary, the Seventh-day Sabbath truth, and a modern manifestation of the spirit of prophecy. These three key revelations helped lead many through the disappointment of 1844. And it was the last of these in the person of Mrs. Ellen Gould White, who was to continue to act as a compass for this fledgling group of believers well into the 20th century. It is to her story we turn next.